This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 28th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm very pleased to have with me today Bill Cheswick, who everybody calls Ches. Hi, Ches.
Howdy, Gary.
Bill Cheswick is the lead member of technical staff at AT&T Research.
A lead member.
Oh,
there are many lead members, yes.
Ches started using computers in 1968 when I was two and has been working in computer security for over 35 years. Among many of the cool things and major accomplishments that Ches has done, he coined the term proxy in its firewall context in 1990. He also penned Firewalls and Internet Security with Steve Belevin, now at Columbia. And for a while, Ches was the self-described hood ornament for Lumetta Corporation, which commercialized his internet mapping work. Ches lives with his wife, Laurette, in New Jersey, in a house with its own star portal and several importantly distinct sets of barbecue tongs.
You'd bring up the barbecue. They're an important part of our security.
Importantly distinct sets of barbecue tongs.
Yes.
So the first edition of Firewalls and Internet Security appeared in Las Vegas in 1994, along with the first of a huge pile of commercial firewalls. Back around then, I think there were fewer than 20,000 web servers, only 4,000 or so at the beginning of 1994 and about 20,000 at the end. Things have changed just a bit.
A bit.
So are we winning or losing the computer security war?
Well, you know, I'm a pragmatic kind of guy. And the bottom answer at the moment is everything's working.
All right.
I mean, if you ask a room full of techies how many people are doing online banking, maybe 70% raise their hands.
Mm-hmm.
How often do you go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble or other online stuff and do shopping? That stuff's working really well. Get your news on the net. Use Google to go search for stuff. For most people, most of the time, the Internet's working great. So I would say, in that sense, we're doing fine.
Yeah, that's a good pragmatic answer.
Okay. Now, of course, there's this lurking possibility of giant meltdowns and unsafe software and all this other stuff that all us security weenies especially are aware of, that this might be a house of cards that will collapse someday. But at the moment, it seems to be fine.
So some researchers claim that attackers have evolved from pimply-faced teenagers perpetrating virtual joyrides to organized criminals perpetrating serious fraud.
I am convinced that's exactly true.
So you completely agree with that?
Absolutely.
Have you had experience dealing with both sets of the pimply-faced people and the organized crime people?
I have had more on-the-ground experience with the early pimply group than I have recently. I've done more with internet mapping and non-security stuff in the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
But I have friends in law enforcement and people who watch the dark side very closely, and I monitor what they're telling me, and it's quite clear that though there are some pimply people out there, the people we really need to worry about are the experts.
Do you think that the experts are evolving technologies in ways that the pimply-faced kids couldn't? Or they're just using the same tools? What do you think?
Well, no. There's no question that they look over the shoulder of the kids. These kids come up with new ideas. I'm not saying that they can't. But the pros write excellent code. They've got a budget and so on, and they're making lots of money.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever been a victim of virtual fraud yourself?
To the best of my knowledge, I have not.
Congratulations.
Well, I some of that I think is personal care, and some of that might be whether I'm on the radar. You know, it's not clear to me what the reasons are.
Right. So in 1990, you coined the term proxy in relation to firewalls.
Yeah.
I think it was in the paper The Design of a Secure Internet Gateway, which I read recently
after
you sent it to me. Now everybody uses proxy firewalls, and we still have a huge security problem.
Yep.
And so, simple question, do firewalls suck?
Well, they don't suck. They're sort of middle-level security.
Uh-huh.
In fact, the paper you described was a high-level security firewall, high assurance, well, somewhat high assurance, belt and suspender sort of firewall.
And that was also back, I guess, when you guys had one internet connection for AT&T.
Actually, there were more than one into the company at the time. My design got adopted by the rest of the company, and at one point there were six or seven of those.
Ooh, six or seven.
Well, there were 130,000 machines inside. Uh-huh. Eventually, you're circling the wagons around Wyoming. And
right.
That, of course, is the problem with all big companies.
Right. So what do you think about firewall technology? Obviously, everybody's using it.
It's a useful tool. It's you know, there was a brief period around 1997 when people thought, gosh, I have a firewall, I must be secure.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of naivete went quickly.
I think there's still people 11 years later who believe that.
Oh, I have not run into them recently, but I take your word for it. They are misinformed. it's a useful tool, like a router or a packet filter or you know, software checking tools and all that other stuff. It's a useful tool.
Uh-huh.
It's helpful to limit who can access what parts of what networks.
Do you think that proxy firewalls are being used in generally the same way you guys anticipated when you invented them?
Yeah, I would say yes. Obviously, the traffic that they're carrying is a little more sophisticated. I mean, port 80 back then was pretty much a quiet, empty place. Now it is a festering swamp with all sorts of things that are pretending to be web services plus web services themselves.
Right.
So the job of the application gateway of the proxy for that particular service is much more complicated than it used to be. But the idea is pretty much the same, and the use has been pretty much the same as well.
Mm-hmm. So you know I'm a big proponent of software security.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe even a born-again evangelist is the best.
Yeah, yeah, it's good stuff. I hope you win.
So in your view, are we making any progress in that, or is it mostly just like lots
I have
of
not
yelling
seen
and screaming?
Any. It has been obvious for, what, 40 years, maybe 50 years, that we don't really know how to program very well.
Uh-huh.
And the security implications are we don't know how to do security very well. I hope that guys like you win. You know, it's my computer, it's my hardware, it's my software, I've got the home field advantage. I ought to be able to win this.
Right.
You know, these guys are remote. They're in Latvia or someplace. All they can do is send packets to me. So in principle, I ought to be able to win this.
Yeah, you shouldn't accept those Latvian packets.
Well, I don't know. Sometimes people from Latvia want to talk to me, but you get the idea. I would love to have this fixed somehow, but I think for a while we're going to be stuck with the engineering problem of trying to engineer secure or reliable systems with unreliable components.
Right, and you think that progress has been, what, very little at best?
There are things that are better. I mean, certainly compared to 1990. For example, we won the crypto wars.
Right.
You know, SSH, though not perfect, and I sure wonder if there's a day zero that the Chinese government know about in it, is much, much better than any tool we had back in 1990, and is probably good enough. So you know, that's better. SSL is good. It's a good thing. We've got that. That's a nice tool. And there are software tools out there that I think are settling down to being reasonably useful, and I mean that not in a scientific, robust software engineering good job, but in the engineering sense of, we haven't had many problems with it lately.
Yeah, so we can use them.
So we can use them, like Apache 1.3 point whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's pretty much sitting there just sort of solidifying, and though it's too big for me to trust, I'm spent the last week trying to jail it, in fact. Well, I can't trust these things. I need to do belt and suspenders and maybe
right.
some more. So we have things like that in PostFix and some other tools that I think are showing themselves to be fairly robust. And I'm looking forward to virtualization.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that
later on,
so I'll go ahead and do it now. So Boon or Menace?
Well, virtualization, you know, sandboxes can be things like chroot and other things in operating systems,
mm-hmm.
and much better things than chroot. And that gives you belt and suspenders, the belt being the security of the original application. This gives you a third thing. We don't really have a name for belt suspenders and what? Low-hanging blimps. I don't know what it would be.
One of those glass walls that the mimes use, I think.
That's right. So I think virtual memory, not virtual memory, virtual machines can give us another layer, but I don't want to oversell it because the interface between the hardware and the kernel was never designed as a secure interface.
Right.
Therefore, there are hardware-like tricks one could play to fool the kernel. They always trusted each other.
Yep.
So this is not the most logical place to draw a security border. On the other hand, it's a different kind of border, and it's just one more thing for the bad guy to have to break out of.
Turtles all the way down.
Turtles all the way down. We're turtle manufacturers.
So when I came to visit you at AT&T Research this spring, the parking lot was full.
Yeah.
Plus, you were doing many cool things that I'm not allowed to describe.
Well, that's true.
So what's it been like to go through the AT&T breakup and then startup mode at Lumetta and then the SBC reassembly of AT&T?
Oh, this gets so complicated because people think that AT&T is Bell Labs, and of course that's part of Alcatel-Lucent and unfortunately seems to be a smoking ruin. The folks at AT&T Research at Shannon Labs, many are left over from the old Bell Labs and the trivestiture of 1996. A lot of them are old friends of mine.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them are new people. It's a terrific place. It's 300 very cool people doing very cool things. It feels like a slice of Bell Labs to some extent. Certainly the intellectual environment is like that. It's wonderful to be able to just go down the hall and ask a world-class mathematician some math question or, you know, consult with a world-class statistician about a stats problem. This is the sort of stuff that was great at Bell Labs.
So it's an environment that you really appreciate.
This is where I belong in corporate research. This is really just wonderful.
How about your stint in startup mode?
I loved the startup mode. It was not only gratifying to take a research project and make it into something that people were willing to pay money for. I mean, I know it's a bunch of shell scripts and cron jobs and C programs, but the guys who are buying it are paying, you know, $400,000 based on this sort of stuff and liking it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a very cool thing. I think it's also helpful for researchers to get out in the real world, see what the business is like, what business cases are like, go listen at venture capitalist conferences and see what people actually have spent money on.
Mm-hmm.
This has been an invaluable experience for me, and now that I'm back inside AT&T, I'm more likely to hear an idea and say, you know, that could be a project.
Right. So
that could be there's a business there.
It informs your tech transfer capability.
It does.
And that's always the hardest problem in a research lab.
Well, it's partly informing and then partly getting a large company to do something about it, and that is also a problem. There have been a bunch of ideas that have come up. In fact, I've been cranking out patent applications, to my surprise, just sort of getting into this creative mode.
So next I wanted to ask you two questions that I asked Ed Amoroso in a previous episode.
Okay.
So we can compare answers with some sort of a blink test later on.
Yeah, Ed is my boss's 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 boss.
There you go. So this is going to be really a fun experiment.
Oh, that's okay. Ed's a good guy.
So here's the first one. What's your opinion of moving security into the cloud, the idea being that it's rather silly for each individual customer to invest so much energy on the endpoint filters and like firewalls and IDS systems?
Well, of course, that was exactly the idea of the firewall in the first place.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, if you think of an internet with no firewall, putting a firewall somewhere out there is in the cloud. I think it makes sense for some things. In fact, I tried to get AT&T into that business in 1991.
Uh-huh.
That was a little ahead of its time. It's now a billion-dollar business.
Right. Yeah, and people are arguing over who invented it. Not that we'd be speaking to one of those guys or anything.
Well, I'm not sure about inventing. It just occurred to me that, hey, we got these firewalls and they're pretty secure. Gosh, AT&T could sell safe access to the Internet. Wouldn't this be a great idea?
Right.
That idea was not falling on fertile grounds in 1991 in AT&T, where they were still in love with the copper mine in the sky, the phone system. and frankly, that would have been too early to do a startup with that as well.
Sure.
So but here's... it was an obvious idea. I think it's a reasonable idea for some people to do that. What I'd much rather is that you succeed and that my machine is just so armored that I can skinny dip on the internet and not have to worry about this stuff.
Yeah, don't hold your breath for that one.
Well, I've been doing it for 10 years.
So here's the other question I ask, Ed.
Yeah.
You guys at AT&T are in a great position to monitor the cloud.
Absolutely. It's part of our job,
but
actually.
But there's a danger that comes with that power to look and to filter.
Right.
So how do you personally feel about privacy, customer privacy, and the sort of the way they trade off against security?
This has been, well, of course I do not speak for AT&T, any version of AT&T on this, but this has been an issue with the phone company in any description you want to call it for the last 100 years. On one hand, you have to run the network, and that means you sometimes have to monitor phone quality and circuit stuff, and that means you have the ability to listen in on anything.
Mm-hmm.
So you need that to run the network, and you need that to run an IP network, a big ISP. On the other hand, there are privacy issues, and the company obviously has a strong need to have the customers trust us that we will do the right thing. And from what I can see from the inside, we do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
We try very, very hard to keep this data extremely well protected, as near as I can tell. I haven't run a personal audit on it, but the bits I've seen, it isn't like I can just shuffle down to the end of the hall and go tap somebody's telephone call.
Right.
These things are studied for statistical purposes, and when law enforcement comes along, well, the company has to respond. And, we just had a law passed that identified the phone companies for this, and I think that was a good thing.
Mm-hmm. So, in your view, what about traffic analysis? You know, the idea of who's talking to who, when. Is that a privacy concern, too?
It is an incredibly valuable tool. I speculate that the spooks are much, much better at it than the rest of the world. There isn't much literature on it out in the real world.
Uh-huh.
I think it's a rich place for research out here in the public world. Obviously, we have the databases inside AT&T that we could do this extensively. But of course, for a research project, how would you publish this?
Yeah, right.
All the attempts I have seen at anonymizing data, whether it's the Lawrence Berkeley Labs packet data or some of the other stuff, has all backfired.
Right.
This was something I wanted to do at Lumetta. Lumetta had seen scanned in detail perhaps 50 corporate intranets around the world. This is a view of networks that nobody else in the world has ever seen. Wouldn't it be nice to sort of anonymize all this data and make it available for research so that researchers could have some idea of, the various math and layouts of corporate networks?
Right.
And I could not think of a way to anonymize this that didn't look suspiciously like someone could figure out who the customer was.
Yeah, it's a good open research question, I think.
Yeah, well, so we never did it. Just could not convince myself there was a safe way to do it. And I think that we're running into exactly the same problem with packet traces and, sure, inside AT&T. And I think this is a fundamental problem, an obstruction to research mm-hmm. in the Internet and Internet security, is getting access to packet data.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the internet mapping project stuff
okay.
that you did. So I guess you instituted that long ago with Hal Birch.
That's correct.
And transitioned that into Lumetta.
That's right.
And we made some really gorgeous maps, which was cool.
Yeah.
So here's the question. If you were a bad guy and you had to abuse the mapping technology, how'd you do that?
Well, the best way to abuse it, I think, is to use it on someone else you're going to attack.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe you're hinting at perhaps I could put up a fake network that would give false responses.
I don't know. I was just wondering if you thought through that.
Well, the easiest thing is to just block it. You could offer up a phony network and have them come and scan the network and feed information. And, this gets into spy versus spy stuff.
Right.
And you could imagine that spiraling around a lot. And I'm sure it does to some extent. But I think the technique is much more valuable on offense, and would counsel people that if you have low TTL packets arriving at your machines of interest, there's someone showing unusual interest in what you're doing.
Right. So tell us an interesting story about an application of the mapping technology.
Well, of course, for corporations, just finding out where the corporate network goes was a big win. And it was always interesting to look at the first map of a corporate network. These things would be colored with known and unknown and that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it, generally speaking, there'd be, you know, the network expert would look and say, what's that? Ha! You know, they were supposed to, we sold them 2 years ago, they were supposed to be disconnected. Or
right.
Those guys in Oklahoma, I knew they were running an open router. Look, it's right there. So you'd get stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
It was often hard to tell what people wanted. And, of course, what we did was we produced a report that produced answers to every question you might ask.
Right.
As a big sea of web pages. Well, one of the reports was routing loops. You know, early in the Internet Mapping Project, we just threw away error conditions, but later realized that there's gold in them, our ICMP packets.
Right.
So we'd find out routing loops and that sort of stuff. So we made a report with routing loops. You know, this we never got to the destination because your packets bounced around forever.
When would we figure AT&T would like that sort of thing?
You certainly would.
No, I mean keeping the loops
well,
around.
Well, that's right. It keeps more traffic. And there are people who saved money by just finding unused connections and said, oh, gosh, we don't need that T3.
Right.
Or that routing loop is using too much capacity. What surprised me was I was told that when the network mapping project stuff was run on CIPRNet, the secret government network,
mm-hmm.
the first report they looked at was routing loops. And you could imagine that there might be some low capacity, top secret lines that you'd want to make sure don't get loaded too much.
Yeah, right.
So that's pretty cool.
That is pretty cool. So among your many interests, and your many interesting home automation projects.
Yes.
Is a set of Christmas lights.
Yes.
That are automatically controlled.
By a computer.
That's right. So have
in
you...
In a non-tacky manner.
You keep emphasizing that.
It's important.
So have you thought of uses for these lights during the summer?
No.
Well, how about possibly transitioning them to solstice lights instead of Christmas lights?
To what kind of...
Solstice lights. You could do them twice a
year.
Oh, yeah.
Well, one could certainly do that.
Do you think your neighbors would care?
I think they'd probably like it. I actually think there may be a local ordinance about how long you're allowed to keep Christmas lights up.
Well, that's why they're not Christmas lights.
Well, that's right.
Hello.
Yeah. The other thing is I'm not sure those lights are really certified to work work all year outside.
Oh, no, I'm only thinking twice a year, so we move up from just Christmas time
to
I see.
June
and December 21st.
Well, yeah, I want to put on solstice lights. Of course, they wouldn't be on very long, would they?
No, just twice a year.
You know, they'd come on at, 11 o'clock at night?
Okay, well, thanks, Chez.
I'm delighted.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. The September-October 2008 issue of IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine is a special issue dedicated to virtualization. It'll be co-edited by Sean Smith and Sam King. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by InformIT. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security/BSI-sub. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.